This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on Sundays at 8 p.m., rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And there are now more ways to stay in touch with the union. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Tenant rights is a critical issue in New York State, and DC 37 has joined the Housing Justice for All Coalition to fight for a legislative agenda that will stabilize neighborhoods and eliminate the control corporate landlords have over housing in our state. To talk about this issue, we are joined in the studio by Housing Justice for All campaign coordinator Celia Weaver to discuss this issue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The rent's too damn high.
That's true. That's true. It's true across the city and it's true across the state.
And what are the proposed solutions for this, and what's the best way to get to those solutions?
Yeah, so we have a package of bills that are before Albany this session. It's 9 different bills that would go a long way towards limiting landlords' abilities to price gouge tenants, to raise rents when the landlords right now have a huge financial incentive to harass tenants, evict tenants, push people out of their homes. And we have a 9-bill package that would strengthen and expand people's rights to stay and hang on to their homes. And also, give tenants really the right to organize for dignity and for better living conditions in their homes.
I understand that the rent is too damn high. I also understand that tenants need protections. But I would have thought that New York State was ahead of the curve in terms of tenant protections. What are the deficiencies that currently exist that need to be really strengthened?
Yeah, so New York has one of the country's oldest systems of rent regulations, and it's got one of the most powerful tenant movements in the country. Unfortunately, New York is also home to Wall Street, and it's also home to one of the most powerful real estate lobbies in the country. So I heard someone say once, and I like to repeat it, that real estate in New York is like oil in Texas. It is the industry that is driving politics and attempting to influence decision-making in our state capital. So because of that situation, you know, you've got a really powerful tenant movement on the other hand, and you've got a really powerful real estate industry on the other. We have a system of tenant protections that has been poked with loopholes.
Are these tenant protections statewide, or is New York City better than the rest of the state, or is the rest of the state better than New York City? If you are a New Yorker, are there better places to live because of the rent protection, tenant protections that you're talking about?
Yeah, so New York City renters, right now we have a system of tenant protections that only applies to people who live in buildings with 6 or more units built before 1974 whose rent is less than $2,700 a month.
And if you're left-handed, and if it's a Tuesday. I mean, they seem to have narrowed that down somewhat, didn't they?
That's exactly right. And so all of the sort of loopholes in our system are designed to make sure that the system disappears through attrition. So it's a big race from the real estate industry to one day have that number of apartments be zero, and tenants are fighting like hell to expand that number of apartments. Right now, we've got about 1 million apartments in the city that are impacted by where tenants have the right to a renewal lease, and rent stabilization only applies to cities in 8 counties, so the 5 boroughs: Nassau County, Rockland County, and Westchester County. What we're doing this year is we're fighting so that every municipality, every county in the state can opt into rent stabilization if they want to. And we're fighting to bring the right to a renewal lease to every apartment, no matter how big the building is or how much you pay in rent, so that every tenant in the state has some basic set of protections that will allow them to fight for their homes, their communities, to stay close to their schools and their jobs.
I lived in Washington, D.C. for the first 6 years of the Obama administration. And when I came back to New York, I was stunned by the amount of unfettered construction there was in New York City that seemed to be connected to the policies of the mayoral administration that was in place at the time. And that it was certainly true in Manhattan. I don't know how much of it went into the outer boroughs, but there seemed to be a huge push to make it possible for the developers and the owners to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more difficult to have tenant protections as a result of that than prior to what I perceive to be a period of, as I say, unfettered development?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something that is true in New York State and really, you know, across the country is that public policy rewards homeowners and landowners and punishes renters. So what we saw in the Bloomberg administration was rezoning policies that encouraged high-end luxury development in low-income renter neighborhoods and zoning policies that protected property values and protected neighborhoods from development in sort of white homeowner neighborhoods. So we saw a huge incentives for property owner for big developers to build luxury buildings in working class renter neighborhoods with an increased, which would lead to an increased pressure on tenants as landlords want to sort of push them out so that the market in that neighborhood shifts. So landlords want to push them out and bring in someone who's going to pay more in rent.
I was just looking out in Queens at apartments to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And what was unclear to me was when I asked the question, is this a rent-stabilized apartment?
Mm-hmm.
You could get a whole weird response that was more confusing than not,
mm-hmm.
depending on whether or not it was a condo building that was being sublet or
mm-hmm.
whether or not it was this apartment was rent-stabilized, but now it's not rent-stabilized because it's above a certain level. In the simplest of terms, if you would, please,
sure.
Celia Weaver. Explain what a rent-stabilized apartment is, and when somebody tells you that it was rent-stabilized and it's not, what happened there?
Sure. So rent stabilization applies to rental buildings that are built before 1974 with six or more units, and it applies to the individual apartment. So if the legal rent, the rent that the landlord is allowed to charge according to the state, is less than $2,733 a month. So the three things to look for are six or more units, rent is less than $2,700 a month, and the building is sort of built before 1974. You can add apartments to rent stabilization if the landlord and the city have entered an agreement. So landlords can opt into rent stabilization in exchange for a discount on their taxes. So some do that. But your typical rent-stabilized apartment is, like a pre-war building
mm-hmm.
In some of those neighborhoods in Queens you're talking about.
We are talking with Celia Weaver. She is the campaign coordinator of the Housing Justice for All campaign, the goal of which is to implement statewide legislation that protects tenants' rights. Is that
right? That's right, yeah.
And how are we doing? DC 37, let me just take a step back. DC 37 is involved with this campaign. We've been recently involved with, as we speak, there will be in the city council a vote on an environmental bill that we believe is very important to both the future of the city. We're talking about protecting tenants' rights because we believe that our members live in this city. We believe that we service this city. And in order to build a better city, there are certain things that we have to do. One is to make affordable housing for the middle and working class in this city. The question I have is, what do we need to do specifically over this legislative session, the next legislative session, to make changes take place?
So what do we need to do as tenants? Yeah.
Yes.
So,
and as advocates.
And advocates, yeah.
And as people who are talking to legislators about changing the rules.
Yeah. So I think we're doing great. We are doing better than we've done in years, but we're not doing good enough, and we haven't won yet. And you can't take anything for granted in Albany. So the State Assembly has come out in support of 8 out of our 9 bills. We need them to come out in support of all 9. So you can call your State Assembly member and you can ask them to support good cause eviction legislation, which would bring the right to a renewal lease to every tenant and almost every tenant in the state. The state Senate still hasn't said anything. So we can, as tenants and advocates, we can call on our state senators to endorse the full Housing Justice for All package. And our analysis is that we really need the Senate and the Assembly to speak strongly to the governor and say, this is what our constituents need. And that's how we're going to get the governor signed on to this package.
Can you tell me a couple of things that landlords do that they're not allowed to do so that listeners who are renters, who are trying to protect their rights, know that, no, you can't do that? Is there a list of maybe 3 things that if your landlord's doing this, it's wrong?
Yeah, so your landlord should not be allowed to raise your rent more than the rent guidelines board than the rent guidelines board says every year. So it's typically, this year it's been between 0.5% and 1.5% or 2%. So if you see a rent increase that's bigger than around like a 2% increase, you should look into that. Your landlord cannot harass you and tell you that you have to leave your home or that they're not going to renew your lease. Most rent-stabilized tenants in New York have the right to a renewal lease. So landlords are required to provide that to you, and they're required to make sure that rent increase is something that is, you know, within the acceptable range. And then, you know, landlords are required to make repairs. Landlords have to provide heat, hot water, a working refrigerator, a stove, and those costs should not be passed on to tenants unless the tenant has agreed to pass on the costs of those things on to tenants. So tenants have pretty strong rights. Unfortunately, landlords are encouraged by state law to fraudulently break, to like not enforce the rights. So it's a big struggle to get the state doesn't have the resources it needs to actually make sure that landlords are behaving in the way that they're supposed to.
Is there any advantage to checking, doing a history of the rent before you take the apartment?
You know, it can be hard to do before you take the apartment because in this unfortunate market-based system, tenants just don't have if you find an apartment and you can afford it, you really want to get that quickly. But you should always get your rent history. And I'm going to read out the number so that listeners can make sure that they call DHCR and request their rent history. Then you can see if your landlord is fraudulently overcharging you. The number is 718-739-6400. And to get through the phone tree system quickly, you can press 1 and then 7 and then 1 again. And you'll talk to someone at DHCR and they can send you your rent history right to your apartment.
We just have about 30 seconds. Give us that number again.
Okay. 718-739-6400 and request your rent history so you know that you aren't being overcharged.
And finally, to find out more about the campaign, where should listeners go on the internet to find out more?
Yeah.
We have about 15 seconds.
So you can go to www.housingjusticeforall.org. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Housing for All NY, and we're on Facebook at Housing Justice for All.
Celia Weaver is the campaign coordinator for the Housing Justice for All campaign. DC 37 is proud to be a part of that campaign. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm just going to take a minute to read the lead of a news story from last week's Daily News. One-time radical activist Judith Clark, imprisoned for 38 years as the getaway driver in a botched 1981 armored car heist where two police officers and a security guard were gunned down, was paroled Wednesday in a decision both lauded and reviled. This is a decision that, this is a case that we have talked about before on this show. Tom Robbins, who is the Pulitzer Prize finalist, the capo di tutti capi at City University's School of Journalism, former reporter of the Village Voice and the Daily News, on the phone with us now to talk about this case. Welcome back to State of the Union, Thomas.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
You wrote what I consider to be the definitive piece about Judith Clark's quote-unquote transformation. And that piece was written in the New York Times, published in the New York Times 7 years ago. And it was talking about her changing from the radical activist that she was in the 1980s and 70s to the person that she has become and who is, you know, has been in prison for 38 years. One of the things that struck me about that piece, or many things struck me about that piece, but one of the things that struck me about that piece is that you began that piece by talking about the fact that you did not agree or even particularly like Judith Clark. Tell us who Judith Clark is and was and her story.
Well, let me be clear. I mean, by the time that story appeared and by the time I made the decision to write it, my opinion about Judy had changed 100%. I mean, she was someone that I knew back in the 70s in Brooklyn. She was the high school sweetheart of one of my closest friends, and she had a wonderful smile and a great laugh and the politics of Joseph Stalin. You know, she just was really an appalling zealot in those days. And when she later appeared, you know, having been part of this terrible crime, I wanted nothing to do with her. And I had nothing to do with her for more than 20 years until people who knew her kept coming to me and saying, Judy has really changed. She is not the person you remember, and she has really changed how she feels about the politics that led her to that terrible day. And I was pretty skeptical, but I did go up to see her And it was the first of several dozen visits that ultimately led to me do a story. And I talked about her radical transformation, which was actually the title in the Sunday Times magazine.
Clyde Haberman, a former New York Times reporter, wrote yesterday on Twitter, "No doubt there will be protests against parole for Judith Clark, but either we believe parole has meaning and people are capable of redemption, or we admit our system of criminal justice is a fiction." One of the things that we've been talking about within DC 37 is the need for criminal justice reform. How does this play? How does this case play into the bigger issue of criminal justice?
It's central. I mean, look, you know, this phrase mass incarceration that, you know, has become so popular. The premise is that most people, especially in New York State, are being held for violent crimes in which people were injured, and some of them horrific. And just yesterday, ironically, the same day that Judith Clark's parole was announced, I published a story at the Marshall Project and in The City, the new website about New York City, about the fact that the Brooklyn District Attorney Eric Gonzalez is having a dramatic change in his policies regarding parole for people that his office has convicted of serious crimes. And he was doing it, as he told me in the story, because he understood that people can never change the fact of the crime. That is something that remains the same no matter how much they may change themselves. But that if we don't recognize the ability of people to show remorse, regret, and rehabilitation, we'll be stuck forever in this cycle, and mass incarceration will continue to dominate at great cost to almost every level of society. And Judith Clark is probably the poster child for that because, look, prison was good for her. You know, I've said that before, and it's true. You know, she went to prison, somebody who was screaming epithets at people in uniform and saying all these things about the dog imperialists. And she actually came to recognize that people in uniform, the guards that were guarding her at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, had the same everyday problems that she did, that they had children that they worried about, that they had spouses that they had to worry about, and that their lives had more in common than the other side. And I think her transformation, which has happened over the last 20 years, I mean, I think that she's a very special person, but she's not the only one. There are a lot of people like her who are stuck behind bars.
You know, I was reading the New York Post yesterday, and it's interesting how newspapers cover stories and the headlines they put on the stories. And in the early edition of the New York Post yesterday, it was pointed out that Judith Clark received one of the longest sentences of her six co-defendants, the majority of whom are either deceased or no longer in custody, and that her only female co-defendant, Kathy Boudin, whose participation in the underlying crime was similar to Clark's, received a 20-year minimum sentence and was paroled in 2003. So the question I have is, what is it about Judith Clark that made it so difficult for people to come to terms, especially those who are, you know, who are opposed to her release because of the fact that law enforcement and people died in this terrible incident? What was it about her that made it so difficult for her to get the parole? Two years ago, she was denied parole in a unanimous vote. What happened there? What was that about?
Well, look, I mean, I can't explain either one of these votes. The one that went against her came after the governor had said that he thought she was eminently capable of living in society and that there had no one to fear from her. And then this panel this year came to the opposite conclusion, a split decision, 2-1, but they still decided that she was safe to release. But, you know, in terms of your larger question, like, why does she attract such opposition? You know, it has something to do with, you know, she was captured at the scene. You know, she didn't get away. A lot of people who were involved in that, the guy who orchestrated it, who masterminded it, they all got away. They were caught years later. Judy went to trial and was her own worst enemy. She insisted on not offering any kind of defense. You know, given every opportunity, she just denounced the judge and denounced the system. And she sat actually in a basement listening to the testimony piped in. And the judge said, I don't think you're capable of rehabilitation. And he gave her what's called triple life, the maximum for each person who was killed, the two police officers, Edward O'Grady and Waverly Brown, and the guard from Brinks, Peter Page, a total of 75 years to life. And I'm not sure I blame him at the time. You know, Boudin, Kathy Boudin, was wise enough at the time. She had a father who was one of the most brilliant civil rights lawyers of his time, who persuaded her to take a guilty plea. That was after Judith and co-defendants had been convicted. And she was sentenced to 20 to life, and the judge even said at her sentencing, you know, if she doesn't become a problem while she's incarcerated, she deserves release. She ended up serving 23 years, I think, before she was paroled. And that was controversial. But, you know, one of the things when I was reporting the story for the Times back in 2011 that really startled me was that the people in Rockland County, who rightfully are very, very angry at the people who did this to their community, they think it was kind of their 9/11. You know, it was just such a shock. People remembered that day clearly, you know, decades later. But they had no idea what had happened to the people who actually pulled the trigger. They had no idea what happened to the guy who was the mastermind. One, the officer who actually arrested Judy, told me he thought he was dead. And I said, no, he's not dead. He's actually in a federal prison, and he's up for release in a couple of years. And it was just, you know, Judy was there at hand. She was the symbol, you know. I mean, make of that what you will. I mean, she was a woman. She came from a middle-class background. She was white. I think there were a lot of reasons why people were angry at her than they were at other people involved in there. But she remains that symbol for many people. If they were able to sit across from her face to face, I think she would become the symbol for something very different.
We have just about a minute left. What do you know of how she plans on living the rest of her life?
Quietly.
Okay.
She is not going to be a public figure. She tells me she is not looking to beat the drum about causes. She will do the same quiet, good work that she's been doing behind bars. Oh, she'll work with people who are just coming out of prison on reentry, and she's been involved in this marvelous program that they call Puppies Behind Bars, in which she trains dogs to be both, you know, help people who are victims of trauma. I mean, most ironically, for the last couple of years, she's been working with law enforcement veterans who are traumatized by 9/11 and other incidents. Here's Judith Clark, the terrorist behind bars, training the dogs that help them get through their lives. She'll keep doing that kind of work.
Tom Robbins is Pulitzer Prize finalist, and you are the, what is this title? You're the director of investigative journalism? No, that's not correct.
I am investigative journalist in residence at the Craig Nomark Graduate School of Journalism, and that means that I have a little cot that I sleep in there.
Listen, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Chris. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right. That's just about all the time we have for this show. Before we go, an announcement. If you have maintenance issues in your rented apartment, come to a workshop on maintenance and repairs in rental housing with special speaker NYC public advocate Jumani Williams on Wednesday, May 1st at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For more information, call 212-815-1111. I want to thank our guest Celia Weaver from the Housing Justice for All campaign and Tom Robbins. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.